You're listening to Precinct 444, a podcast network from the National Law Enforcement Museum. Today we're bringing you an episode from the Encore series, where we revisit past museum programs and conversations.
Welcome to part two and our final look back at our program entitled 9/11, Memorials and the Meaning of Memory. In our last episode, we met our stellar panelists and our moderator, who introduced their specific memorials and started sharing their stories. In part two, we'll continue reflecting on the roles these memorials play in our lives. As a reminder, our panel includes moderator Braden Painter, Director of Methodology and Practice for the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience, and panelists Stephen M. Clark, Superintendent for the National Parks of Western Pennsylvania, including the Flight 93 Memorial, Jim Lachak, Executive Director of the Pentagon Memorial Fund, Amy Weinstein, Senior Curator of Oral History and Vice President of Collections for the National September 11th Memorial and Museum, and our own Pat Montori, then Executive Director of the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial.
Where all of you have mentioned change in a number of ways. And I think sometimes when we start to think about memorials, and so often we create memorials in really permanent materials, marble and granite and steel. And we think they're these sort of unchanging objects. But each of you has talked about some way that the memorial, the area around it, that they're growing, they're changing, they're being added to. So I'm curious, if you think over the course of the life of your memorial so far, what have been some of the biggest changes in how it's been used or experienced by visitors?
I can go first if that's okay. And as usual, I'm not going to answer your question 100% directly, but you made me think of something. Yes, we are stone and metal in the parapets, but water and the trees are softer, they're more organic, they are a living, breathing part of the memorial. And so I think it's interesting that you said that memorials are built to be solid, to be permanent, to be unchanging, but people change them. We knew that family members and perhaps friends who visited might want to leave flowers or small tokens, but we did not anticipate that people would do things like use scotch tape to make sure that their tribute would stay. So we've had to evolve ways of, and it's very important to us because it was important to Michael Arad's vision that every visitor in the morning experience it as though it was the first day, as though for the first time, with no flowers left from or flags from the previous day. So that's another, maybe not change over time, but change as part of the memorial. People come, they leave an American flag, the pilots and flight attendants leave wings or other pins, people leave notes, people leave memorial cards or mass cards, in addition to flowers, or people also leave personal, highly personal items. Ballet slippers and a jar of beach sand were among the very first tributes left on the memorial, and we had to scramble a little to make sure we understood for whom they were left and to make sure to save them with the appropriate contextual information. So I think that the memorial is the same every day, but it's new every day. And I think the water and in the past few years, you could see the trees grow. They were skinny little things when we first planted them, and they've grown upwards, they've grown outwards, and they're they make a real difference to the life on the plaza, I would say. I guess, sorry.
Go ahead, Amy. I'm sorry, ma'am.
That's okay. I just wanted to say I've had the privilege of visiting. I think I first visited Flight 93, maybe in 2007. So I've seen that one grow. And I first heard about the Tower of Voices behind you, Steve, on that visit. And I have been waiting ever since to see that. I've been back several times, but not since it was completed and that auditory element was added. So I am so looking forward to another opportunity to hear that, to visit again.
Well, thank you, Amy, and I can share for those viewing this particular panel. If after the panel you went to earthcam.com and then typed in Tower of Voices, you can actually view and listen to the tower 24/7. And since we dedicated in 2018, we've had over 3 million views. So really a beautiful part of the memorial. But you know, I was going to add, Amy, something you said triggered me with kind of the bricks and mortar element of certainly Pat's the law enforcement memorial and certainly the incredible majestic beauty at the Pentagon. And certainly the elements at Flight 93 have that element of bricks and mortar. But another part that I think is often overlooked is the natural element. So when Flight 93 it plummeted into the earth, it went into an abandoned strip mine. And so it was a very scarred landscape. And over time, the original design with Paul Murdoch from Los Angeles, also a design competition, part of that design was 150,000 seedlings. So about 8 years ago, we started what we call reforestation, plant a tree at Flight 93, and you know, kind of 12, 15 inch seedlings, which are now well over 10, 12 feet high. So it's pretty cool. And I'd love to next year have Jim and Pat and Amy have a group because we're right at about 132,000. So we will reach our goal, COVID dependent, next April, late April. And we'd love to have a group of volunteers from the respective memorials come help us celebrate that milestone, which again, turning that scarred landscape into the beauty that we see today. So again, certainly an invitation from our partners at these great, great memorials to come late April. Maybe kind of put it in your notebooks there to come and join us for a day or two.
Would love to.
Yeah, I'm going to take you guys up on it.
My birthday is in April, so I'm definitely coming.
Mine too. I'm April 9th. So.
Oh, that's great, gentlemen. I love it.
I mean, if I may add just a piece, and you know, I you know, when you talk about bricks and mortar, and earlier I was saying someone had asked me how you feel when you walk through. I mean, the powerful feeling of this wall was the importance of when we had to expand. How would that look? What would that view look like? And I know that the process in Washington, D.C. is no easier than anywhere else. I mean, you have the Commission of Fine Arts and Historical and all the areas that are so pure and important. But what we wanted to make sure is that this memorial looked like it grew rather than it expanded outwardly in a way that it scalloped in a way to where you would look at it and it would look natural. If it had to look so unnatural, people would be asking more questions and they wouldn't have the feeling and the emotion that we all want our visitors to have. And that is that peaceful understanding where we heard Amy eloquently saying they leave these belongings and personal notes and pins and things. And we want to make sure that we don't take that away. But unfortunately, we have a living memorial, and so is 9/11. As we see over 300 names of post 9/11 deaths because of cancer and 72 on the onsite of when we engraved and you know, the following year. But the importance of it is that, you know, we are evolving because the world has evolved and changed. And our adaptation and our assist and people who responded have made our lives easier and possible and more palatable and possible. But their sacrifice now is that makes our memorials grow. And we don't know with COVID, as we saw, COVID has been like, you know, a leading law enforcement concern. As we see 300 line of duty deaths to date, this very date right now, 177 of them are COVID related. 46 are traffic and 46 are gunfire. And then we have 31 that are other. You take a look at those numbers, you're taking a look at increases. What's going on, right? So we have to think about how do we adapt. But when you said a question earlier, and I don't mean to take much time, but I wanted to say, you said, you know, who does it impact? I think that all these memorials have to impact everyone, because it's not meant to be a private thing. It's not meant to be for one group, one person, or one thing. Because if it does, you've not made what you think you should have made. And that's the beauty of art, in order for someone to feel and express themselves in the way they feel necessary to honor those who have honored them in whatever capacity it may be. Whether it's an officer, whether it's a mom, it's an aunt, it's a brother, it's a sister, it could be from any capacity, as long as they can honor them faithfully and responsibly. Thank you. Sorry for taking up so much time.
Oh no, Pat, it's great. Great conversation. And you got me thinking about a couple of things I wanted to share as things change over time. The first trees that we planted at the memorial, and this was some feedback from some of the family members. They said, you know, don't make it 184 trees, because with my luck, the tree representing my loved one will die. So the idea was to have trees there to make it more park-like, and but not to make a one-for-one reference. It was meant, you know, the memorial units themselves, the benches representing each person who died. But it was interesting, the first trees that the designers wanted to put in, they planted, were Japanese paper bark maples. And those trees did not do very well at all, because we discovered later that those trees needed to be under a canopy. Well, there's no canopy next to the Pentagon. So those died, and we ended up putting in crepe myrtles. And those have flourished. So it's been interesting to see now, as you drive by or as you walk through it, how the plant life and the vegetation has really made it a very special place. It's next to the Pentagon. It's next to a major thoroughfare. But a lot of times I go in there and you lose yourself in the memorial, and you kind of think about what happened there, the impact it's had. And you don't hear all the street noises nearby. And I can remember when we were meeting for the jury, they said, you know, this is going to be a place that's hard to get to because it's on the Pentagon. So we want to make sure there's enough meaning and enough things to consider so people can spend some time there. And it's really evolved into that. Another story I'll share is that the way the memorial units are organized is you have, five children that were killed on Flight 77. There was two little girls traveling with their parents, Dana and Zoe Falkenberg, and three kids that were on a National Geographic school trip with their teachers. And so those age lines are very near the entrance of the park. So you walk up and you'll see five memorial units with some trees scattered around. And then there's a big gap. And it's interesting how people react to that gap, because it picks back up with someone, you know, the three kids were 10 and 11 years old, born in by 1990. They're on the 1990 age line. And then it picks up again with someone who was of working age. So they were like 22, 21 when they died. So it was probably, you know, sometime in the 80s when they were born. And that's been interesting to see how people react to the fact that, you know, these were children when they first come up to those benches. And then it picks up with working age adults. Because I don't think a lot of people recognize that. Yes, it was the nation's military headquarters that were hit, but you had five children that were on Flight 77 that also died in that attack.
And so I think we're laying out a couple of interesting threads to follow, and one that maybe we'll set aside for the landscape architects another day, but this like really powerful idea of the connection between nature and natural environments and healing, and the way that that can be evocative for us. And if we had hours, I would love to keep diving into it. Kind of one of these other threads that keep coming in, though, are the number of people and voices that get connected to this, sort of at all levels, from talking about even the design competitions to families and descendants and survivors to visitors from locally, regionally, nationally, internationally. Each of these places that you care for and the stories that you think about touches a lot of people. And it impacts them in different ways. And so I'm curious how you think about balancing all of these voices, making space for all of these voices, and when you choose to kind of center on some within that kind of the larger set of people who are connected to a site.
One of the things that generated the idea of the Visitor Education Center was the ability to share some of these stories and talk about what you just mentioned. And the Visitor Education Center, which we're planning for now, has exhibit space. And the exhibit space is all about the response and the continued response. I mean, the memorial and our visitor experience is about what happened that day and how we responded in the years after 9/11, the war in Iraq, the creation of Homeland Security, the way we board airplanes with all these different agencies that were set up to oversee that, but then also how we continue to respond today, almost 20 years later. So it's interesting, and I feel that we're fortunate because our visitor experience is again about what happened that day, but then what happened after 9/11, how we continue to respond. So it'll allow us to, continue to tell those stories and be relevant, because you think about how much has happened in the 20 years we've been reminded of it because of the 20th commemoration, about all that's happened, and we still continue to deal with terrorism and deal with these issues. I think it's just been very interesting to kind of think back and reflect on all that's happened just in the short period of time, when you think about it, 20 years since this all happened.
I could add that we offer interpretive guided tours of the memorial. I was lucky both times that I visited the Pentagon Memorial to have learned about it from two different people. But, I'll just say, nonetheless, I was floored both times when I saw Dana and Zoe's names. I knew who they were. I knew exactly how old they were. I knew why they were on that plane. But I kind of emotionally flipped out, because I was looking for their parents' names. I was looking for Leslie Whittington. I was looking for their dad. And I knew where their names were with their age, but I will tell you, I started to cry because I thought, oh, those little girls aren't with their parents. But even though there was good reason, and once I remembered, I was, it did make perfect sense. So I think having that interpretive tour for people, even though all of these places, Flight 93 and the Pentagon and ours, they're totally self-guided. You can totally understand a lot. It's nice to have a little bit of interpretation. And through those interpretive tours, whether it's in person or through some of our audio tours, you can learn a bit more about the unusual things that certain people did, whether it was Wells Crowther, the man in the red bandana who's so well known, or the firefighters who were, and police officers who were trapped but rescued from Stairwell B. Trying to think of some other examples that's another growing part of the memorial, is learning from the public about what they want, including from teachers and school groups who visit.
I'm curious, these are really interesting and powerful examples. I'm also curious, thinking about some of the things that folks might encounter in memorial spaces that they are connected to where they are, how you start to think about voices that are coming into conflict with each other, right, in these spaces, as they want to remember differently, as they want to express different kinds of impacts, right? This could be descendants and family members who want different things from a space, right? People who had really different kinds of lived experiences of one of these events or the aftermath of them. And so I'm curious how you think about having voices that don't always necessarily agree with each other be connected to these spaces.
I'll jump in, real quick and be brief. One of the things that we're trying to do with the Visitor Education Center is have conference space as well to be able to have some of these discussions, Rayden, that you're talking about. I can imagine symposiums and things like that that we could have and bring people in and different speakers in to kind of talk about some of these things you bring up, how we've changed, how we look at things differently. What does that mean as it relates to looking back on 9/11? So those are some of the things that was the genesis for the idea of the Visitor Education Center. One, as Amy mentioned, that there needs to be some kind of interpretation there for people to understand what happened, because it's sometimes it's too hard to figure out unless you're there with a docent or with someone to explain it to. But then the idea of being able to have conferences and talk about these things with groups of people, that's what we're hoping to do with the Visitor Education Center once it's created.
A few weeks ago, family members and synagogue leaders of the Tree of Life in Pittsburgh, and I don't think they'd mind me sharing this, but they came to Flight 93 just before September 11th and shared an entire day. We spent the entire day together, along with the president of the families of Flight 93. And the objective of the visit was they too want to memorialize and take special care of their loved ones who died in October of 2018, 11 total in that shooting. And I think that's the beauty of memorials collectively, that we're all in this together. And sadly, I'm sure that we will continue to work with one another and help the next memorial through the trials and tribulations of the successes in New York and you know, the law enforcement memorial and the Pentagon, and we're continually evolving. But one thing's for sure, my day stops when there's another group of men and women who want to do something special for their community or for their families or for their loved ones. And that's something that we all take tremendous pride in. And one further thing I would say is that our oral history program, you know, that's Amy's really pride and joy of bringing together individuals who were there, you know, a state trooper who was first on scene or a firefighter from Shanksville. We have over 880 oral histories. And we share them with researchers and on our websites and so forth. But folks, as we all know, we're not going to be in these positions forever. We're going to give the next generation of our successors these tools. And before you know it, it will be 50 years. And yeah, the Park Service in my case is in the forever business, but I really feel collectively with the experts who are able to do these oral histories with those who were there. And that to us is a very important element, just like it is to, you know, Jim and Pat and all the other memorials around this great nation, really kind of solidifying in time a piece of history, tragic as it may be. And oftentimes, Braden, that's exactly what they are, but they're our history, and how we remember them and talk to those who were there is really critical to our journey.
I couldn't agree more. And the memorial, you know, fortunate in a sense, each year during Police Week, we make sure during our vigil that we are, giving the most amazing, we feel, tribute to however many names of officers, had lost their lives in that previous pub year. And doing so, we share educationally to the families and to civilians and to people across our country and outside our country about the sacrifices and the stories of law enforcement. And then like a memorial, like we expanded, as you know, Jim, you're saying educationally, we thought educationally too, we wanted a museum. So we expanded also to a museum, but in doing so, we also want to go back to our stakeholders and make sure that our stakeholders are being represented the best they can. And then survivability for us, in a sense, as we are not federally funded and desperately need the assistance from all our stakeholders. And that's everyone. That's not just law enforcement. We wouldn't be around if it was just one culture or one group. We have to survive together through education, social media, partnerships, and also through donations and the ability for us to survive and for our memories to continue. I think that this year we're having, just in a few short days, we're having our candlelight vigil where we're having it live right on the mall. And it's going to be, for 2 years of our surviving families that will be read that year, over 700 names. And as we celebrate their contributions and their memories, we're educating the community and public that although COVID has stopped and we couldn't do it again this past May, we did not stop. And that's our duty. And as people who run and represent are ever changing, sometimes has to evolve, Braden, with what goes on around us. And normally in October, although it's the 30-year anniversary for the memorial, it's not the reason why we're having it. We're having it so we can honor very powerfully, appropriately for our fallen and for their families. And that is the most powerful education you could provide to anyone, where you could feel it in your heart, you could feel it in your mind, your body, and your soul. And as you hear Amy and you hear Stephen and you hear Jim talk about all the memorials, we all have that because they represent true heroism, true selflessness from all aspects, from that child all the way up to a senior. So that's the honor I have to be a part of and to hopefully share with all of you and share in the future and educate the public. And it's very unique that we have this opportunity, and we should do it and do it with all our honor and representation for the best interest of all.
It's impressive to even hear the way that you've impacted each other across your sites, right? That visits to each of these sites have impacted you personally, again, that kind of the personal as well as the larger one. And it's, people have talked about education in a few moments here. And right, again, Pat, what you were just trying to talk about of, right, this doesn't just live in the mind, this is living in the heart, this is living in the body, this is living in the spirit. And so one of the challenges, and I know you all try to put really positive things into the world through your institutions, right? And one of the challenges that memorials and memory workers around the world face is that, right, the subject matter that we're engaging with evokes all of these things you've been talking about, grief and pain. It evokes the kind of beauty and the unity that you've mentioned as well, and the sort of some of the highest virtues of humanity. And as people come into contact with that, our reactions can be really positive. That can, grief and pain and virtue can push us into really positive reactions, and they can push us into really harmful reactions too. And so I'm curious, in your education and the way you construct these sites, how do you try and help people come into contact with these things and find their way towards responses that are really positive towards themselves and towards other people?
I can try to tackle that a little bit. And I should say that I'm a curator and an oral historian. I'm not an educator by training. So I'm giving you my sense of what our educators do. But I think two things are very important. Well, three things are very important to our educators. One, we want to help kids especially, but people of all ages, find themselves in the story, either as responders or perhaps through the canines who came to be part of the search and rescue and the therapy dogs, and with the ethnic diversity, to be able to, people from more than 90 nations were horrible. It's horrible to say that people from more than 90 countries were killed. So we want people to understand it wasn't just Americans, it wasn't just New Yorkers, and that our visitors from all over are part of the story. Another thing we try to, I hate to say, use the word combat, but I can't think of a better one, is we want to provide accurate information so that children especially can learn to distinguish between conspiracy theories grounded in thin air and actual reality, history, facts from the people who were there or who studied the attacks and what happened. And the third, it's very important to us to not incite or create Islamophobia or to foment hatred on any level. So I would say those are the three, those are three big areas that we, that our educators try to touch on, that that's important. In the museum, more in the, that's the job of the museum, is to present, to interpret, to educate. The memorial is more about the people who were killed, but as I said, more than 90 countries, almost 3,000 people.
Folks, I was just going to just kind of capitalize a little bit on the education element. Braden, you had asked about, you know, whether it's our ambassadors in New York, they're known as docents, and Jim, I believe in that at the Pentagon, they're known as docents. And but the fact is that these men and women, many of whom have been here for over 20 years, literally since day one, they come here on an ongoing basis to try and bring a smile or just a warm heart as a greeting, oftentimes not even having to say anything, but having the visitor know that they are there. And we could not do what we do at Flight 93 without our ambassadors. More than 10,000 hours a year for a very quaint, small little hamlet here outside of Shanksville. It's remarkable what our volunteers do. But that being said, we also have instituted a significant distance learning program. And if COVID, as challenging as it's been for all of us in so many ways, one of the bright spots is that it really kind of forced us to look at the technology element. And so we have been doing webinars and so forth not too long ago. We've reached over 350,000 students across the United States with the technology. I can't even do it in an Excel spreadsheet, but there's a lot of these young kids that sure as heck can. And they are able to bring these programs to VFWs, American Legion, senior centers, high schools all over the United States. And I'm very proud to report that next year we're going to go to Israel and Germany and New Zealand and bring these programs to those in other countries. And for us, it's not just Flight 93. You know, we talk about the nation, we talk about the other sites, but we also have themes about courage and doing the right thing and patriotism. So it's very, very coordinated. And I think when students, whether they're fourth grade, eighth grade, 11th grade, or whomever the recipient is, when we hang up that Zoom, you know, end, close, it's our hope that they have a little different perspective with themselves and those seated right to the right of them and to the left of them about being a better person and better stewards of this great nation and the flag we honor so greatly.
I was going to comment a little bit on what Amy said about combating conspiracy and then the no Islamophobia. It's been interesting. We've been pushing out a social media campaign, and we've had to get to a, because we get responses through social media about how can you be raising money for an event that never happened? And we've been trying to do something called myth versus reality. You know, people say, well, there are no parts of Flight 77 that were found. So we're showing pictures of, well, yeah, here we go. It's right here outside the building. I think some of it might be that you know, they people could actually see the buildings hit New York, but you know, they didn't see something hit the Pentagon because it happened so quickly, or there weren't cameras in the field in Shanksville. So it's just strange to me how people can think that this is an event that, you know, didn't happen. The other thing that I think is about the no Islamophobia. I can remember being interviewed by somebody a year ago, and they were asking me, do you hate Muslims? And luckily I had the presence of mind to say, no, I don't hate Muslims. I hate terrorists. Because I grew up in a military family, and we actually spent time in Tehran, Iran back in the 70s. My dad was stationed there. And I can remember my mom saying, you're not going to be an ugly American. You need to respect different cultures. You need to accept that. And I think one of the stories that sometimes, you know, is not told is where the plane came, Flight 77 plane came through the building is probably 50, 60 feet away from a non-denominational chapel at the Pentagon, where services are held almost daily. But more importantly, every Friday, there is an Islamic prayer service held there because there are Muslims that serve in our military. And there's chaplains that attend to their needs. So again, we talk about this, just the stories and combating some of these ideas that people don't understand what happened. That, to me, is, again, the importance of the Visitor Education Center and being able to get out some of these stories out there to combat some of these things.
Stephen, you've talked about the being in the forever business. And Pat, you've talked about how society continues to change around us. And so I wonder if we kind of turn, we've looked in the past, we've looked in the present a little bit. I wonder if we just think for a moment about the future that lies ahead of us all. Right, as society will keep evolving and our relationship to past events will always change. I live in Maine and was in Portland just the other day, and there was a small memorial to the Maine, the battleship. And I was thinking about how different my experience of that memorial would be from somebody from 1900. These things shift and change over time. So as you think about the future of your memorials, you've talked about building a few buildings and wanting to start some new programs. I'm curious, even beyond that, sort of how do you envision the memorials needing to grow over the next couple of years or decades? Where do you see the growth coming for these? Yeah.
If I may just say, I think from the memorials perspective, we need to be able to hit and all voices and all ears. Whether it's through social media, through education, we shouldn't have any barriers on communication. That should be our high point. And I think our adaptation has shown that when you have, you know, people in areas of social media and marketing to help you provide those resources. But when we do things like our events and memorials, who are we touching? How are we able to bring everyone to those things? How is everyone being a part of that? When I say everyone, and touching every populace. Not just law enforcement, when the candlelight vigil, we share it with everyone. And that's why you want social media, you want to be live and taped. You know, we want to make sure it's in the classrooms, we want preparatory aspects when it's over, people seeing things in the museum. You know, you want all those things to just, you know, work together. And as we have with our new CEO, Marcia Ferranto, she had very clearly created the three pillars of our organization. And the foundation being the memorial. And then you have the museum, where you see the memorial, you have the sacrifice, the remembrance, the honor, and the commitment of the officer. And then the stories continue on into the museum. And then on the third pillar, that is the education portion of us. And that's where we try to do our officer safety and wellness, Destination Zero programs, enhancing our social media outreach and best practices programs for law enforcement. And this is all done without federal funding. We have grants for certain things that we were able to achieve through these programs, but for overall, the memorial is not federally funded. So we have to figure out ways to be able to reach everyone where it's not so easy to just say to one core group, this is what we do, the message goes out immediately. We have to think beyond that, outside the box, as you know, everybody would say, or my teachers would say to you, think outside the box, Patrick. Well, we have to think outside the box for us all to be able to make that adaptation. So, and, you know, we are in many ways very strong things of concrete and stone and steel. But our beauty is our ability to adapt to our social needs and being able to socialize our stakeholders into that environment, into our world, and have them see it from afar when they can't reach it and drive to. They could see it from a classroom to learn the historical aspects. And as they can see it during the time when it's the stakeholders for Police Week, where they feel important, as they should, for the sacrifices of what they do each and every day and willingly do. So I say that's the story when you would look at it from the memorial's perspective on how our adaptation and how we're going to move forward. with the best we can, you know, communicative, transparent, open, with honor and powerful statements of what our contributions and stories are specifically regarding a memorial and a museum. As you see, you know, Stephen, Amy, and Jim, powerful. Their stories will be easily shared and told as long as we have the ability to share it amongst all those waves. And I'm talking about the media too, where we wouldn't have to just ask for them to be involved. They should be naturally involved in wondering what's going on in our worlds each and every day. As we share the most important part, and that's the remembrance of what historical contributions these folks have given. Thank you.
Yeah, well said, Pat. And if I would, I just wanted to share September 24th is a very big day for this site for two reasons. Number one, it's the day September 24th, 2001 is the day that the FBI turned over the site to the coroner and the local law enforcement community. And then it's also the day in 2002 that George W. Bush, as I mentioned, signed this memorial into law. September 24th, just a few weeks ago, what we did was we brought back, we sent out an invitation nationwide to every single first responder who was at Flight 93 between September 11, 2001 and September 24th, 2001. And I'm happy to say that we had about 130 individuals, many of whom flew in from the West Coast, from Texas. We had retired state troopers. We had retired FBI agents, Red Cross, firefighters, DMORT, you know, the mortuary group that came in, and as well as two FBI chaplains out of the Pittsburgh division who were there in 01 and who were still on the job, and a few family members. So we brought together, as a cop, I have to have a name for every operation, and we called it TY924. Thank you, 924. And it was a beautiful, beautiful event on a Friday afternoon, and it culminated with the family members inviting all 130 of those individuals to the crash site, to the rock itself, to the boulder, and leading in prayer and moments of silence. And it was for all 2,977 lives that were lost that day. Very, very powerful, powerful afternoon. And then thanks to our friends group, it culminated at the local American Legion, where individuals were able to leave the memorial and then go and have a beer and a cheeseburger and a roast beef sandwich, and really kind of that continuation, many of whom had not seen it, you know, hadn't been back since 01 and hadn't seen so many colleagues that meant so much to them. So I just wanted to share that, again, my connection to law enforcement is profound. And again, honoring these men and women in law enforcement, we do it every day. And we invite game commission and troopers and law enforcement, DEA, to train here kind of in the back 40, so to speak, with canines or whatever it may be. And again, it's who I am. It's who I'll always be. And again, having been to the memorial, law enforcement memorial several times, and being so closely affiliated with the mall and U.S. Park Police and others, again, it's such an honor to be a part of this and hear from Jim and Amy and these other places of remembrance that mean so much to not only the United States, but to so many around the world.
Yeah, I was just going to say one, what got me thinking about something that Pat said, you know, all voices, all ears. When you talk about the memorial is going to, Pentagon Memorial is going to be there for as long as hopefully the Pentagon will be there. But what changes is the discussions you have with visitors, and you need to be, and I think that's what we're trying to do with the Visitor Education Center, to be continue to be able to evolve and meet the needs of different groups. But I think I wrote down the word discussions. You know, it's asking the hard questions, or it's talking about 9/11 and what happened and what it looks like 20 years later, 30 years later, 50 years later. I think we need to be prepared to continue to evolve and have discussions and serve the needs of the generations that are growing up after 9/11. So I think that's going to be an important part of the education center and the programs that will continue to evolve. I don't know what they're going to look like, because you just don't know what the needs are going to be, you know, 10, 15 years from now, but it's important to be adaptable, I guess, and be able to develop the new programs that support the needs of future visitors, because the memorial will be there, but it's how we look back at it differently that will change and evolve. So that's what I hope for with the VEC, to be able to have these types of discussions.
No, and that's why we continue to collect objects and oral histories. We are far from finished. There are so many, we've acquired so much, but there are so many more stories to learn about, new perspectives to hear from, to hear about. And the objects that survivors have saved, the 20-year mark, I think freed some people up to let go of some of what they've been holding, whether it's a survivor's dress or sneakers, and the voices and the impact of COVID, the impact of what has been happening in Afghanistan. The world keeps being the world, and there are connections between the attacks of 9/11 and other attacks around the world. And if the connections are not literal in terms of ideology, in terms of who did it and why, still the notion of terrorism is what binds terrorism and memory is what binds all of us together.
Thank you all. And we have many, many more things to talk about, but I think our time together is coming to the end. So maybe one last question for everybody as we think one more time about the folks who are listening today, whatever that today may be for them. As you think about the folks who may have been able to come to your sites, or they may not have yet, right? Hopefully they'll get there sometime in the future. What's one thing, an action, a mindset, a perspective, a value from your memorial that you hope they would take away with them and live with for the next however many days? So something they would take from your memorial and do or hold or live going forward.
I'll jump right in. Mm-hmm. I hope they would take away honor, commitment, that responsibility and respect, and share that, you know, how impactful it is to feel that someone would give their life for me and do that willingly. And people are out there still doing that. That's what I want people just to realize, that impaction you have to feel that there. And if they could feel that, then they understand a true emotion of the 22,611 on the East and the West.
Tough to top that, Pat. But I would say something very similar. The first word you said was honor. And that's the exact same word that came to my mind, is that, you know, honor the sacrifice of those that died on 9/11, those on the airplanes, those inside the buildings, including the Pentagon and the World Trade Center buildings, but also those who are dying each and every day, both through suicide, as well as the ramifications from the medical complications and the disease that is now coming. And it's a plague for so many first responders at all three attack sites. I can assure you of that. And I think that's where collectively as a group, you know, we remember those that died that day, but also that we continue to honor our first responders. I think our law enforcement officers need us today more than they ever have. That to say thank you and just go up and shake a hand and just let them know that we appreciate what they do. And the first responders, the EMTs, you know, the paramedics, firefighters, and we could go on. But that's why Flight 93 in my particular case, but I think all memorials that we're here discussing today, that's what we do each and every day, is bring those people's memories alive, and at the same time letting folks know to appreciate those who help us at our biggest time of need. To me, that's what we try to do.
I would say that I agree with everything that Pat and Steve and said. And I would just add this. When I walk through the memorial, I look at it, I think about, you know, we're all brothers, sisters, moms, dads, have nieces and nephews, uncles, you know. So when you look at the cross-section of people who died, I would like people to think that, you know, we're more alike than we are different. And I think that's, to me, the message that I stay with as we look forward to trying to create a special place for people to have these discussions.
And I don't know how to answer that question. So I'm going to answer it just a little differently, because I do agree with what everyone has said. But one thing that I think one of the most important things I've learned as an oral historian is how being compassionate was such an element of the response, and the response starting on those planes and inside the buildings the moment the terrorist action began. The care and the compassion that those and courage and bravery, but I'll just limit it to compassion, that the flight attendants felt for their passengers, who they felt responsible for, how the people inside the towers held the door for each other, helped each other down the stairs, the kids and families in Canada who made apple pies and arranged to truck them to New York across the border, the woman in Iowa who set about to make a quilt for every single 9/11 family member. I think that's the underlying theme, is the human compassion that saw the light of day on September 11th and afterwards.
Well, thank you for those. And thank you all for all of the insight and perspective that you offered us today. So Jim, Pat, Stephen, and Amy, right, much appreciated. Thank you for all of this. And to everybody who's been taking time to listen today, thank you as well for spending time with us. And we hope that this enriches and deepens and enables you to take on some of these questions in your own communities, wherever they may be, whether those might intersect with one of these sites at some point, or if it's something that you're building and supporting people with around you.
"9/11 Memorials and the Meaning of Memory" was a chance for us to ask key questions about the role of memory in our lives. Why do we make memorials? Why and what do we memorialize? How do memorials from the past influence our present and shape our future? Given the prominence of memorials to the lives lost during the 9/11 attacks, as well as our own National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial, honoring officers in the line of duty, it's worth taking a step back to consider what role these memorials play in our lives. As we conclude our look back at 9/11, Memorials and the Meaning of Memory, our hope is that you'll never take these memorials for granted, and that they'll be for you places of reflection, of healing, of hope, of whatever personal meaning you need to find in these sacred places of remembrance. If you'd like to watch this program, we're proud to say that C-SPAN Television picked up this program for inclusion in their series entitled American History TV. We'll link to their coverage of this program in the description. And as always, thanks to Christopher Mitchell, our manager of digital content and strategy, for producing this podcast episode. I'll also add that, as with all of our Encore episodes, Chris was also the producer of the original content from the program. Thanks, Chris. Thanks to all of you as well for listening to this episode of Encore, a Precinct 444 podcast from the National Law Enforcement Museum. Join us next time for another look back at some of our best programs from the past.
Please subscribe to Precinct 444 on your favorite podcasting platform to stay connected and to receive our latest content as soon as it drops. We would love to hear from you. Send in your questions, comments, and feedback to precinct444@nleomf.org. You can help us make our content even better. The National Law Enforcement Museum is located at 444 East Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., and is dedicated to telling the story of American law enforcement. We expand and enrich the relationship between law enforcement and the community through educational journeys, immersive exhibitions, and insightful programs. Find us online at lawenforcementmuseum.org and stay tuned for more podcast content from Precinct 444. Until next time, stay safe. We'll see you at the precinct.